We are talking today with Cody Lundeen. Cody Lundeen is the founder of the Aboriginal Living Skills School located in Prescott, Arizona. He is also an adjunct faculty member at Yavape College and a faculty member at the ECOSA Institute. He and his school have been featured in numerous media outlets, including The Today Show, The Discovery Channel, The History Channel, Dateline NBC, CBS News, USA Today, and CBC Radio 1 in Canada. He is the author of the best-selling book 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive. And he is here to talk about his new book, When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes. Cody, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me.
If you would begin, start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing When All Hell Breaks Loose?
The motivation for that was, on my publisher's end, it was 98.6 was doing very well. They contacted me and said, hey, we'd like to do an urban survival book based on 98.6 degrees. And the clincher there was, we'll help you write it. So ding, ding, profit. So, and I was like, no. And so for the first year, I said, forget it. And I wasn't interested in doing that because I didn't want to squeech with 98.6. Later on, after looking at the political scene, and I'm not going to swing this is a nonpartisan interview, but staying alive is a totally nonpartisan issue. I didn't like the way things were being handled. I thought I could do better. I didn't like the fear factor in America and where this country was going with that, with the last two elections. So I thought, you know, I will write this book. But, you know, let's leave 98.6 out of the mix, and that's what spawned When All Hell Breaks Loose.
Okay, so this book deals more with an urban situation.
Yeah, you know, I've never been to Seattle before. I flew in yesterday. Your city kicks ass. Oop, your city is wonderful. The parking is tight, but I do love Seattle. I think it's really an interesting layout. So regardless of whether you're rural or urban or suburban or whatever, this book is for Joe and Jane Americana. If their house is pulled, kicking and screaming off the grid, what would you need? You know, all of a sudden the grid's down, the power's out. So it outlines specific chapters and whatnot about what every American or every person on the planet should have on hand if the grid went down for whatever reason.
Okay, so I got the impression from your book that actually a lot of surviving in situations like disaster situations is more mental than physical. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it is. The book is divided into two parts. The first part is head candy, what you have in your head, human physiology and psychology. The last part is hand candy, you know, how to poop in your backyard, how to disinfect water, whatnot. Survival is 90% psychology, so I don't give a damn what Mike has in his garage for survival gear if Mike is too scared stupid to use it, because your psychology dictates your physiology and vice versa. So seeing as how that a survival situation scares people, your heart rate goes up, you lose your complex and fine motor skills, I spend a lot of time in the book just psyching people up that, look, you will be scared, here's how fear works, here's how not to be scared, at least as much as possible, and really kind of get into the human psyche regarding survival in general. Because that's kind of the entire cake, and the survival gear itself is icing. So, again, if you eat too much icing, we know what happens. You end up in the bathroom. So let's talk about that cake of human psychology. That's why it's referenced in that way in the book.
Okay. So in terms of disasters, I think a lot of people, when they're formulating that in their head, they're thinking that they're going to be at home, you know, when disasters occur. So do you cover for both when people are at home as well as when they're going to be out, like, let's say, at work or at school or in the car?
Yeah, When All Hell Breaks Loose does cover, of course, it's a book on home survival or urban survival in general, but, you know, human physiology and psychology are basically the same. So if I got compromised here at the radio station, yeah, I'd have a bug out pack. You know, I wouldn't necessarily, I can just see that your co-employees, oh my God, there's Mike with his backpack in the corner again. But I'd want some specific stuff in the trunk or at least somewhere around where, let's say, if I can get to my car, then I can make it home. So that's a good point you bring up about if all your eggs are in one basket, you better not lose that basket. But here in Seattle, you know, you're not at home right now. So I do outline office survival kits, car survival kits, etc. But they're no different than the home survival kit. The stuff is just smaller and there's not as much of it. But the intention to survive is the same. Your physiology doesn't change when you come here to work. You still poop the same way. You still eat the same way. But you should have some eggs that are out of that home basket around here. Basic stuff, extra clothing, a comfortable pair of walking shoes in case you're walking home. You know, some snacks, some water that's disinfected or that hopefully that's potable in the first place, etc.
Okay, so let's assume people are preparing for a disaster. I guess it really doesn't matter what type of disaster specifically it is in the big picture.
Yeah, that's a good question, because there was a few people that said, why don't you cover tornadoes and how about earthquakes and tsunamis? And there is a semblance of truth to that, especially here in Seattle, where you'd want to get the hell out of Seattle. But you can imagine that happening all at once. It's pretty much not going to happen. We saw that with Hurricane Katrina. When people did eventually start to leave, the highways were clogged for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. So let's say that, you know, you have to settle down and be at the house, and you don't have the option to get out of Dodge. Let's say an earthquake. There's very little warning on that. It's just going to happen wherever you are. You're going to mechanically get squished the same in a car accident, an earthquake. It's irrelevant, like you said. So it's not really the effect that I'm looking at with the book. It's dealing with the cause. So whether it's a flood or an earthquake or a tornado or whatnot, again, Mike's physiology is the same, and he's going to require, after the disaster happens, the same stuff to stay alive that you would in any other disaster. So again, to cap this out, there's times when you'd want to move and get away. If there's a hurricane approaching in Louisiana or whatever, they say, get the hell out of town right now. And you could do that and move to a safer area with your bug-out kit or your car kit or your office kit or whatnot. Most people aren't going to do that. There's a lot of disasters where they won't have the time. So again, the mop-up procedure after the disaster happens is pretty much the same. You bleed the same. You go to the bathroom the same, etc. And that's what a lot of people didn't get with the book. You know, I mean, I could have spent 300 more pages describing, you know, specific earthquake skills or tornado skills, you know, get under this and don't stand in this doorway. That wasn't the intention of the book. It was more causal about, okay, here's human physiology and psychology. Here's what it needs to survive regardless of the effect that might happen to us. And let's take it simple from the beginning to deal with whatever disaster might come down the pike.
All right, and I would assume preparation is a big factor in all this.
Preparation's key. That's what the book is about. You know, let's say someone buys When All Hell Breaks Loose and puts it on the shelf and it collects dust. You know, do not buy and start reading the How to Swim book when the boat's going down. You know, this is all advanced preparation, and that's the entire point of the book. Yes, it can help you after the fact, but you'd want to read it beforehand and catalog your gear and get on the same page with your family. And let's say Mike is here and his sweetie's over there and something happens when they're both at work. They'd want to know, hey, if something happens and I can't get you on my cell phone, then the grid is down in Seattle. Let's meet here and let's have a game plan. It's no different than the woods. If you went up to the Cascades or whatever in the mountains, you'd phone folks back home and say, hey, look, we're up on Trail 297. We're leaving Friday night. We'll be back Sunday evening. And if we're not back, then search and rescue will get us. So the who, what, when, whys, and wheres are very similar for a wilderness survival situation as it is in keeping track of your loved ones in an urban scenario.
All right. Maybe you can give us some examples, some details on different things that people really need to prepare for if they go off the grid. I mean, I believe the basics are like food, shelter, clothing.
Go with it, Mike.
Okay. Start with food.
Okay. Food. The easiest way to store food, in my opinion, is canned food. Canned food lasts about 2 years per can. You can write the date on it, or if you buy it by a case lot, write the date when you purchased it. It's easy to eat. You can open it on a brick wall if you need to, if you don't have a can opener. Just with it, you can braid down the lip of that and eat it right out of the can. So there's a lot of different canned foods. There's MREs, there's dehydrated, there's freeze-dried, there's bulk grains, there's cans, there's all this stuff. But for the average Seattleite, it's pretty much canned food. And I recommend people to have at least 2 to 4 weeks' supply. I don't get into how much stuff in When All Hell Breaks Loose, because that's dependent upon the family's intention. I do get into, here's what you need or you're dead, you know, short or long term. But how much the family does, you know, everyone's on a different page with that. You know, in the Mormons, it's 12 months, and for you, it might be a week or whatnot. To back up before that, the main thing is thermoregulating core body temperature. That's why my first book was called 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, because your core temp is about 98.6. And especially here in Seattle, man, it was like, you know, I went from like baking hot desert sun to the weather calls for rain again here in Seattle. And so that immediately drops the core temperature with all the moisture. So if Seattle is pulled kicking and screaming from the grid and your house no longer has 72 degree room temperature, you need to regulate core body temperature first. That's by far, hypothermia is the biggest killer in outdoor accidents in a wilderness survival situation. But people don't realize that, you know, what if I didn't have this alternative heating or cooling source in my desert? What if in June the power grid grows down and it's 118 degrees outside? So that's key. And along with that is water, because water helps regulate body temperature. And I just adore Seattle. I mean, I've seen water in rivers and the ocean and like in movie pictures and on TV. And now I actually see it. And I'm really envious. I mean, I'll trade you sunshine for a little bit of water and then we can grow stuff, because we're in a serious drought cycle now. But how do you disinfect it? You know, there's tincture of iodine 2%, distillation, boiling, pasteurization. There's lots of different ways I outline to make it safe to drink, because you can't assume as the corpse floats by that that water is safe to drink. Clothing is an extension of your shelter. Put on clothes, extra sleeping gear. We have water to help regulate body temperature and, of course, to stave off dehydration. Probably pretty much before food, we're going to want to take a dump. And everyone produces about a half pound of fecal material a day. And you can imagine what it would be like in Seattle if the grid went down and the toilets didn't work. Now, where do you put the poop? Especially in your country, since the water table is so high and the pathogens from poop can, you know, in make this water situation here very, very bad, you know, with epidemics of diarrhea or dysentery or whatnot. I mean, that's the leading cause of death in developing nations is dysentery from non-potable water sources. So people immediately, like you did, and God bless you, you know, food. Let's talk about food. And food is an issue in this book, and it is an issue for short and long-term survival, especially long-term. But it's the little things we take for granted, like room temperature and the cup of water and a place to take a dump, that have precedence over that.
Well, so go into a little more about where do people take a poop? Is it fine to just keep using your toilet? Obviously, it would keep working without electricity, but the pump stations and stuff wouldn't have electricity, theoretically, to
right.
Take
yeah,
that
I mean, to flush your toilet, it uses water, and do not expect the water to be up and running, you know, when the grid goes down. So let's say you're looking at this empty toilet. What I would do is I would harvest out of the back of the toilet, not the bowl, for God's sake, whatever water I could, and then disinfect that. Water is much more precious in your body than it is to flush a turd away. So even if we had this toilet bowl that was empty, we could still put a couple garbage bags and tape them to the lid and poop into the toilet, but into the bag, and take that bag out to a garbage can that's heavily strapped and, you know, with sodium hypochlorite 5.2 or 6% chlorine bleach, and wrap up those packages in plastic wrap and dispose of them until we could deal with that. So if you're in an apartment, you know, like the hotel I'm in is four stories high. I'm not going to go out to the courtyard and dig a trench and start taking a dump. Well, I might. But there's people that don't have that option because they're in an apartment. They can use a garbage can. They can use the existing toilet with plastic bags and then wrap that up carefully and put that in a safe location, which we can talk about in a minute, until the little guy comes around with his truck. Now, if you're in Seattle and you have a backyard, you're pretty much home free. You want to think like a raindrop and not dig a cat hole or a slit trench in an area that's too close to water. But just like when you're camping, you can dig a trench, you know, depending if you have a large family or individual cat holes, and just poop into the ground and then cover it over with the excess dirt that you took out with that. And you can use toilet paper and whatever. I mean, I outline ways to wipe your butt with your hand in the book, or lots of different things that are out there in the woods to do that with, or in your backyard, from newspaper to rags to whatever. But the main thing is to either deal with it fairly permanently in the earth, like if you did have the backyard, or deal with it temporarily with several layers of plastic. The Romans used to just do their thing in the bedpan and throw it out onto the street the next morning. And that's a faux pas if Seattleans do that. It's a major, major cause of disease. But those are just a couple ways with how to short and long-term deal with fecal matter.
All right. Get back to water, if you would, sources for that. I mean, we obviously get a lot of rain here, and it's hard for me to imagine not having that, you know, a rain occur every X number of days. But we actually did, during the summer, have some stretches actually last year where we went for well over a month without getting any rain.
You're spoiled. Well over a month, you know. Man, this is Seattle, isn't it? Lucky you. Well, yeah, and you bring up rain, which I didn't talk about, which I do talk about in the book. Collecting rain is awesome. I collect it in Arizona, and I have literally a 3,000-gallon tank and a gutter system to catch that water. As you're probably, it's like, in Seattle, it's like, yeah, water, haha, why even deal with that? But I'd just be like a kid in a candy shop around here with all the water that you all have. So let's say it doesn't rain for a month. Oh, my God, emergency. I think you have, oh, my God, you have rivers and lakes, and we got to stay away from the ocean. But what I've seen in Seattle is just tons of different water areas that, again, if you know how to disinfect it, harvest it. You know, the streams and rivers, and you want to be prepared. In my country, I'm a desert rat, and water is one of the main things on the list to have stored. I have several thousand-gallon capacity because I have to from where I live because I live way off the grid. That might be a hard one for people in Seattle to wrap their mind around until it's not there. So what I would say is, you know, you go to your apartment or your home, you turn on the tap and everything's groovy and the water comes out. Imagine if it doesn't come out. Where is Mike going to go to get water? It doesn't matter how well you can disinfect water if there's nothing to disinfect. So I would have game plan A, B, maybe C, because every other psycho out there is going to be looking for water too. And then know where to get it, which is just reconning your neighborhood or your area or storing it in the garage or whatnot, and then have a way to make it potable.
And can people make water potable with standard items that are probably like under their sink?
Yeah, good question. That's what I wanted to focus on with this book. Okay, chlorine bleach. Okay, in a bottle of bleach with no phosphates, no perfumes, about 2 to 4 drops per U.S. quart. A quart is almost a liter. Disinfects that water. And we could go pretty into, let's go into detail on that one. So here I have my quart water bottle or whatever. Or maybe I have my 2-liter pop bottle. You know, that's typical trash that people can imagine. That's 2 quarts. I'm going to use 2 to 4 drops of chlorine bleach per quarter liter of water. So in that 2-liter pop bottle, why not load it up with 8 drops of chlorine bleach? I let it sit for about 30 minutes. Now, if the water is very turbid, if it has a bunch of ponds come in it, I'd filter it out with a bandana or a cloth or whatnot. Or if it's really, really cold, I might add a little bit more chlorine bleach. Or I'd let the contact time stand longer, which is 30 minutes. So here's my 2-liter bottle. I can put 4 to 8 drops of chlorine bleach in it, let it sit for a half an hour. If I crack the top of the bottle and I don't smell chlorine, I'm going to add a couple more drops and let it sit for another 30 minutes. That's kind of the no-brainer way to disinfect water. Another one is tincture of iodine 2%, which I use a lot. I also use it as a wound disinfectant. Depending on what your age or where you, when you grew up, now it's all povidone iodine 10%, the generic for betadine, but it's the stuff mom put on the cut that stained your skin orange and that hurt like hell because tinctures have alcohol. I can add 5 to 10 drops of that per U.S. quarter liter of water. But the contraindications of that iodine are no thyroid issue, no allergy to iodine, or not if you're pregnant. So those are two things that people might have right now in their house, let alone boiling. I mean, Seattle, you know, the Evergreen State, hoo-ha, you know, you have all this fuel. Fuel in a pot, you can boil it. So let me ask you this. There's a lot of BS on websites out there. How long do you think someone needs to boil their water to disinfect it from waterborne pathogens?
I'd guess 10 minutes.
10 minutes. And I've seen some websites that say 10 and 20 minutes in the same damn paragraph, obviously written by the 6-year-old in the house. Just bringing water to a boil disinfects it. Okay, if you're at altitude, which we're not, because the ocean's right to our left or right, whichever way it is, you can boil it for another minute or two. So just knowing that I can take funky water and boil it in the backyard or on a propane stove or over a fire pit in the backyard or whatever I have to improvise after a disaster, I've saved time, I've saved water, and I've saved fuel. Just knowing that, no, you don't need to have it rolling boil for 10 minutes. Just bringing water to a boil will disinfect it just fine.
All right. Getting back to food, I think a lot of people might think that they could, in a disaster, if they can't drive, they could eventually get to a store. Although I don't think they consider that the stores need regular deliveries and electricity as well. So what happens when, you know, the stores are fully depleted or depleted enough where you can't depend on them and, you know, your neighbors, you've borrowed all the food you can from them?
Well, It won't be an issue for you, Mike, because you will have read the book and prepared and have stored food. So the thing with this book is like, well, I can reel in the aftermath of the effect, or I can deal with the cause. So, yeah, it's an average stat out there that most grocery stores in America have a 3-day supply of goodies. And you want 3 days to go down to 2 or 1, then have a real crisis hit Seattle here. Store your food. For you or your loved ones or whoever's at the house, make sure that you have, in my opinion, a 2 to 4 week supply of, again, even if it's beanie weenies. You know, I outline how to kill and eat a rat in the book. That would be a hell of a show, wouldn't it? Mike Eats Rat, here, live at 6. So you don't want to do that, man. You don't want to mess with the rats and whatever, and you don't need to. Even if you're eating asparagus for 3 days, you'll be a happy camper. And I outline starvation all over the world that's happened and what people have eaten to really get an incentive for people. Just, hell, when I can go to the discount store and buy a 50-pound bag of rice for $20, there's little excuse not to have food around the house.
Yeah, I believe the been following the potential pandemic outbreak. You know, they're thinking with avian influenza, and the official government length of time that people could be barred in their houses is, I believe, 8 weeks. So that would be storing a lot of food for them.
Yeah, I did some research on the CDC, Center for Disease Control website as well. And if you ever do that, you'll probably fill your pants with excrement because it's not very pleasant to read. And this is from the big cheese. You know, this isn't some wacko in northern Montana, you know, who's built a bunker in his backyard. And they say if an influenza or pandemic flu hits America, that you should be prepared for waves of it, because it would come in waves and come back and then come back again. 2 to 3 months is what they said of being in your house. So that's a lot more food than most people have right now. And again, I don't get into amounts or quantities in the book. That's relevant and that's custom to the family's intention for training and preparing. But yeah, you bring up a good point. I mean, this is out there right now. Someone told me that Oprah had on the lead guy on the CDC like 6 months ago. And she asked him, you know, why do we all have our head up you know where when it comes to this pandemic stuff? And then she answered her own question and said, we're too worried about Brad and Jennifer, aren't we? You know, it's all that's Britney Spears and whatever. And the guy just nodded his head. Yeah, no one cares. No one really wants to know. You know, I applaud this station for even talking about this. You know, I think that Seattle and Portland, Northwest Coast is very progressive. You're very hip. You're kind of ahead of the curve, and you damn well should be because you're at the ring of fire. You have potential flooding, wind, volcanic activity, earthquake. You know, this is a hot zone for natural disasters, and so Seattleans should, you know, have some basic preparedness skills. That should be really a trump card played by the governor or whoever of this state to get everyone on the same page. And yet the book outlines it's Mike's responsibility. It's not the government's, and I'm really big on pushing personal responsibility because that just makes it easier on the entire system if the grid does go down.
All right, so in addition to covered food and water and shelter
and sanitation,
what else do you see as critical?
Lighting. Okay, lighting would be huge. You know, if the studio, if it went down right now, we'd be sitting in the dark and blowing each other kisses. So that's easy to deal with flashlights and batteries. If homes have kids, which a lot of them do, if you get into the candles or the oil lanterns or the oil lamps, or you're dealing with a radiant light source. Okay, so if the candle falls over, then the house can burn down and we all die. So that's not a good deal. With the LED lights, with the Xylem light sticks, with a battery-operated flashlight, there's really no reason not to have light for the night. I just cut off on an outdoor course a couple weeks ago where we were eating rattlesnake and rat, and you know, no flashlights allowed, and we're out in the backcountry of Arizona, deep in a canyon, and the fire is the only thing we have at night for light and to keep us company and etc. So lighting's a huge core value that's easily remedied. Another thing would be communications. You know, again, and what I referenced earlier with you, Mike, was leaving the game plan with family members about, hey, if something does happen, here's what we're going to do. I'll meet you at so-and-so if the grid goes down in Seattle. That's kind of an unspoken game plan that doesn't require any batteries to work. And there's a lot of different things, from CBs, shortwave radio, a lot of stuff that people probably aren't going to have. You know, if the grid goes down, and cell towers are very vulnerable, the internet's very vulnerable. But again, just knowing to have some place to go where you're all together, that would be my first line of communications. And getting to know your neighbors. I don't know how Seattle is with their community programs here, but if your entire neighborhood is hip and on the same page, there's a lot less fuss that's going to happen and a lot more cooperation that'll happen if and when a disaster strikes. Another thing that would be critical is transportation. Okay, you know, I've been driving around here. It's not actually, I thought it'd be a lot worse, the traffic. It's not, you can go to Phoenix during rush hour. It's a nightmare. But if the petrol gets pinched or there's a bunch of traffic jams, I mean, the bicycle would be king, having one of those. And if nothing else, a nice quality pair of footwear, a good pair of walking shoes. I just came from the TV station where the hostess, she was hot. And she was wearing these wonderful pumps. And I don't have like any weird fetish or anything, but she was wearing these spiky high heels that she couldn't go two or three blocks in if she had to. So let's say that the TV station, you know, we succumb to a disaster in Seattle and we're stuck with dress clothes. You're not going to be able to walk even a mile back home without getting blisters. And this seems so simplistic that no one really cares. Just put a good pair of walking shoes under the seat of your car. You know, again, have a place and a way to walk home. You know, you can't, you know, there's no use strapping the bicycle to the car. That's for later. But my thing is to get your family safe and to have an area where you go to, a way to get there via transportation and communication like we've outlined, where you can get to your supplies and to each other so that then you can go to plan B, you know, surviving the disaster after it happens.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are just about out of time. What final thoughts would you like to leave with listeners?
Be prepared. Don't assume it won't happen to you. I think complacency and a desire for comfort are big bugaboos here in America as far as people not thinking, people thinking that they don't have to prepare because it's not going to happen. It can happen to Seattle. It can happen to anywhere. Realize that a disaster situation could happen and prepare for it and be on the same page with your family or loved ones so that when you get scared, and you will be scared, that it's less of a fear factor so you don't lock up. And so that you can use your survival supplies to your best advantage.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mike.
We have just been speaking with Cody Lundeen. He is author of the new book, When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes.